14 and a half minutes to eight on Monday night's Arena. It's the new year, as I'm sure we've all noticed by now. So how do you feel about a bit of dystopia based around a pandemic? Yeah, I feel a bit that way myself. But the makers of The Stand beg to differ. It's a new series. Let's have a listen to a section from the opening of the first episode of the first series.
Bitter days ahead. Death and terror. Betrayal and tears. And not all of you will live through. Dark men grow stronger all the time. I know you feel it too. Soon he'll come to destroy all who stand against him. His kingdom's in the west, and it is there. You must go and make your stand. This is what God wants of you.
Go and make your stand. This is what God wants of you. A clip from the new TV adaptation of Stephen King's post-apocalyptic novel, The Stand. Back in 1978, King's novel described a band of survivors trying to find their way in a world that had been turned upside down and inside out by a pandemic. I joke you not. Chris Wasser has been watching this new miniseries from CBS and Stars Play, and he joins me now. You couldn't make up the timing on this. I know all of last year, Chris, I found myself saying in studio, isn't that amazing that you wrote that piece before lockdown, before there was any talk of pandemic, and look how that song or that film or that play that we're talking about fits in with our current situation. But this is uncanny how it fits in, given that it was written back in 1978.
It really is. Something else. I mean, King, you could not move on Twitter last year, especially around the start of the pandemic, without somebody comparing what was going on in real life to a Stephen King story, specifically The Stand. And back in March 2020, which seems about, 18 years ago at this stage, when the World Health Organization declared a pandemic, Stephen King actually took to Twitter and said, he responded to these accusations that how did you know what was going to happen almost, but he said, no, listen, coronavirus is not The Stand. It's not anywhere near as serious. It's eminently survivable. Keep calm and take all reasonable precautions. Now, that was 10 months ago. That was right on the cusp. That was just before things got bonkers, Sean. So it is uncanny and it is quite unusual, but I'm sure the folks at CBS and Stars Play were only too happy to have actually wrapped the series of The Stand, because this thing has been so long in the making. Right before production on TV and films, TV shows and films in Vancouver were shut down all over the place, because this thing has taken so long to get off the ground. We've heard at one stage that Ben Affleck was involved, John Borman was tipped to direct this thing some 15, 20 years ago. I think the problem in getting this thing to the screen again, because it was a miniseries back in the early 90s, was that the novel could stop a bullet, John. It's 1,152 pages long. So it's been so big, it features so many characters, that it's just had a long and tumultuous journey back into the screen again. But finally, we have a new one this week.
And the basic setup is there is a pandemic, but I guess and I'm giving nothing away by saying this, that the pandemic was in fact released from a scientific place in the middle of the States, and the government knew all about it, and as a result they sent it off to Russia, they sent it off to China, so that it was a worldwide thing rather than just one country, i.e. America, affected by it.
No, that's it in one. Yeah, it's a man-made virus, and it's such a fantastic opener as well. And again, we're not giving anything away. This is just a setup, but it's a virus that begins in the U.S. Department of Defense lab. It's the government has developed this lethal strain of influenza, highly contagious. They've developed it as a biological weapon, but unfortunately, as is always the case in these fictional disaster scenarios, there's always a security breach. And unfortunately, a guy by the name of Campion, Charles Campion, he's a security guard. He panics when this disease is accidentally released, and he grabs his family on the army base where he lives, and he literally drives as far away from this thing as possible. He actually travels 2,000 miles across America, spreading this virus over 2 days, and then within a month, the world has essentially come to an end. There's also an interesting subplot about, how America actually releases the virus into Russia and China so that they're not the only nation that will fall. But as is always the case with Stephen King novels, there's your big plot, there's your big story, but but we're focusing on the ordinary men, the ordinary men and women on the ground. And we're kind of following Stuart Redmond, and he's the first character we meet in both the novel and, you know, this new series, who is immune to the virus. So essentially, it's all about the survivors. It's all about these men and women who are seeing these visions at night when they're sleeping, and they're the only ones in the world that, you know, where humanity is almost extinct, who are immune to the virus. We don't know why, and that's the thing that we're trying to figure out. Why have these people been left behind?
Well, one thing, or two things that they have in common, are two dreams that they've all had, these dreams. What have the dreams been about?
It's so strange, because that sounds like a really ordinary, you know, uncanny setup about this pandemic. But we do trip over into, you know, full on fantasy mode, because when Stephen King was starting to write The Stand, he wanted to write about, you know, an America that was decimated by a plague and that would feature characters like the hobbits and like Gandalf from Lord of the Rings, because he made no secret that, you know, five novels into his career, he was known as the master of horror. He wanted to be a fantasy writer. That was the original goal. So he decided to incorporate this fantasy element where all of the survivors have two different dreams, and it's up to them then which dream they want to follow. One of the dreams follows features a 108-year-old prophet, a Christian prophet, who is calling on them to come out to Boulder, California, and to start a new life there. Another one features a very mysterious, terrifying figure who they know as the Dark Man, but his name is Randall Flagg, and let's just say he's almost the devil incarnate. And you've got, you know, the ghost folks following Mother Abigail, and you've got the, unfortunately, the killers and the criminals following Randall Flagg to Las Vegas, which, you know, Stephen King back in the 1970s said that's the Mordor of the piece. So it's an age old battle of good versus evil, which just so happens to have a story that we can all relate to in the center of it.
Mother Abigail, the character that you mentioned there, played by none other than Whoopi Goldberg.
Hello, Franny. My name is Abigail Freemantle. You come see me at Hemingford Home, Colorado. Can you remember that for me?
There you go, Whoopi Goldberg. And this is the kind of thing that appears, or she does, yeah, she appears in the dream to lots of the characters, and they have to choose, are they going to go with the Dark Man, or are they going to go with the good woman, basically, is what we're talking about, Chris.
Absolutely, yes. So it's, you know, you've got some of our main characters are rock stars, troubled rock stars. We've got Larry Underwood, we've got Stuart Redman, played by James Marsden, who is this very, very agreeable, affable everyman lead, who also happens to be a widower, who also happened to have experienced a tragedy before the pandemic hit. You've got mysterious characters whose past we'll only find about through flashbacks, you know, both in the novel and in the series. It goes on and on and on. I mean, even in the first in the 1994 miniseries, which won a ton of Emmys at the time, you had 125 actors with speaking parts. And this is the challenge then to take a novel which features so many characters, which tries to do so many things at once, and to make space for it then in a 10-hour series. So that's where I think this series then runs into some complications, because you've got a very talented cast. You've got Greg Kinnear in there, Odessa Young, Alexander Skarsgård, and there's an awful lot of goodwill behind here. You know, you can see that it's so well intentioned that you know, Josh Boone, the guy who's been trying to develop this for an awful long time, who recently made an X-Men film, The New Mutants, he's trying very hard to make this work. But unfortunately, Sean, there's a little bit too much going on.
Yeah, I only have to put the hands up and say I saw, I think, 95% of episode one. I didn't get the last maybe 5 minutes of it. But even within the first episode, where you kind of need to be carried along and you need to have a little bit of exposition, there was a lot of jumping around in time, and I thought, hold on a minute. Are we in real time now? Are we in the present moment? Are we in the past? Are we in the future? I don't know where. I find myself a little bit confused. Did that, you've watched more of it obviously than me, does that become a little bit easier as the series goes on?
It does not. No, unfortunately, it doesn't. I mean, look, I know this book like the back of my hand. This is hands down my favourite Stephen King novel. And there were times during the first hour, I've watched about 2.5 hours of this thing. There were times during the first hour when I hadn't a clue what was going on. Mm. It's a very structurally disobedient piece, and it's uncertain what Josh Boone is trying to do, but it kept reminding me of Lost. So you'll remember in Lost, the plane crashes. Everyone survives, and then we get to spend, you know, the first and even the second season going through 30 or 40 different characters and, you know, seeing what their lives were like before the plane crashed. That's what this is trying to do in just 8 hours of television. And when you do that with just 8 hours of television, as opposed to whatever it was, it lost 60 or 80 hours,
yeah,
you have to rush. And there's no room, you know, there's no chance for momentum to build. There's no suspense because we're seeing what characters are like 5 weeks after the virus and then 5 weeks before. You know, you're not really worrying about the fate of any characters because they all seem to, you know, be alive in the present. And there's this feeling that I got throughout it, which is unusual because the first 400 pages of the novel, Sean, are all about just the pandemic, all about what happens at first. It's almost as though Josh Boone or maybe the network, they're in an awful rush to just forget about that.
Yeah.
The plane crash of the piece is in Lost was sensational. In the Stand, the big accident, whatever happened, let's just forget about that. No one need. Maybe there was a feeling with the studio, look, people don't want to see that bit, but you kind of do. You can't just rush to the end of the story without giving us, you know, the beginning and the middle. So it has this non-linear storytelling style that really doesn't suit it. Now, one thing I will say is, though, that there are clearly things put in because they've transported the action, which, you know, when the novel was first published, it was set in the 80s. Stephen King then edited it to take place in the 90s. Now we're in present day. The present day setting does allow for, you know, neat little, you know, comments, commentary in the background to kind of sneak in that we can all relate to. I mean, at one stage you hear news broadcasters saying, oh, it's going to take an awful lot more than a flu to keep us from celebrating our July 4th.
Yeah.
These are things that we actually heard on the news,
yes,
in real life last year. So that's quite interesting. But I don't know what else having it in a present setting really does for us. So it is a bit all over the place, unfortunately, and even confusing for those who have read it and loved it like myself.
I love the term structurally disobedient. A bit all over the place, I think, is the other way of saying that, isn't it? The other thing that I wanted to ask you about, Chris, was I know it's a dangerous thing when you see a writer in any, you know, in a book, if there's a writer, or in a television play, a screenplay, if there's a writer, to think, oh, how much of Stephen King is in that particular character? But there is a young writer in this particular, certainly he's fairly prevalent in the first episode of the series. How important a character is he, and am I way off the mark to be reading any bit of Stephen King into him?
No, not at all. No, and I'm glad you mentioned him because there is a lot of Stephen King in there. Harold Lauder, played this time by Owen Teague, who's probably the most valuable player in this series. I was quite impressed with him because in this series, let's face it, a lot of the characters in here, there's been an awful lot of kickback against the casting in this series. Some white characters in there, black; some Hispanic characters in there, white. It's quite strange. But my problem is that just a lot of the characters don't look, sound, or behave like anything we knew on the page. But with someone like Owen Teague playing Harold, he's captured that, you know, weird, awkward, you know, young adult aspiring writer who keeps getting, you know, rejection letters from publishers, and he's a little bit weird and he's still trying to find his voice. And yeah, Stephen King was certainly putting his younger self in there, where he was like, you know, this loner character who just wanted to get published and that was it. He is a very important character in this series because he is all alone, his family have died, and he just thinks that this pandemic will give him a new start in life. So he is quite watchable. He's played very well. I would actually say between himself and James Marsden as Stuart Redmond, you know, the everyday, the everyman character of the piece, as I said, and really the protagonist and the hero towards the end, those two are making it. Those two are the reason that I will come back to this series, because there's not an awful lot else there that's keeping me intrigued.
Well, what about isn't the relationship that the young writer has a bit of a notion on the Amber Heard character, who was a friend of his older sister, and she kind of babysat him for a period of time. So there's a bit of a crush that has to be worked out there. Does that go anywhere?
It does, yeah. So Harold, long story short, Sean, Harold has a crush on this Franny Goldsmith played by Odessa Young, and the two
Odessa
of them
Young,
end up traveling cross-country. That will go to some very interesting places, and unfortunately Harold's character goes to some very interesting places. So, as I said, it's Harold's character development that will probably keep me watching, and I wouldn't be surprised if in another 6 or 7 weeks I say, look, He was pretty great. The rest of the series, not so much.
All right, so that's Chris Wasser. So make of that what you may. If you're in lockdown, you might be prepared to give it a bit of time and see if it goes far enough for you. The Stand, it will be available to watch on Starzplay, a streaming app via the Apple Store. And it's available from now, I do believe. That is our lot for this evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields, research. Janice Murphy was the broadcast coordinator. Jimmy Doyle was on sound this evening. Tonight's programme, produced by Kay Sheehy. Great to be back. Happy New Year to one and all.